It's safe to say a new wave of social movements has taken the country by storm. From Black Lives Matter to the Women's March to this year's March for Our Lives, Americans are taking to the streets to speak out on issues that matter to them. There's one movement in particular that takes pride in being a bit nerdy. The group is March for Science Atlanta, going to bring together scientists, data geeks, and average citizens to just push for policies that support and reflect research. They are gathering for a rally this weekend. Louis Kiefen is the march's executive director, and we're also joined by its executive vice president, Allison Halterman. Welcome to you both.
Hi, good to be here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So you're characterizing this event as a rally as opposed to a March for Science, which happened last year. How's this different?
So while marching creates really good visibility around an issue and is energizing for the community, we saw a lot of energy last year and excitement. We really want to focus on how we can get people information and tools to carry advocacy forward on these issues. We want our attendees to have things to take away and continue their actions throughout the year. And we think a rally with some exciting speakers and some great organizations joining us is the right way to do that.
What has changed in the world in the last year, in the year since you did the first march? And how will that change be reflected in how you approach what you do this time?
So this year, of course, we've got the same mission as last year. That's advocating well-funded and publicly available science. And we think it's important to the well-being of people in Georgia and the health of our economy. But today, we've got a much more clear path forward for March for Science. We're a lot more deliberate in how we're approaching things. And we're looking forward to what comes next. Last year, we marched. This year, we rally. And we've been cultivating relationships with science groups, AAAS, Science for the People, Atlanta Science Festival, Atlanta Science Tavern. And we're really excited about how this will bring the community together.
One thing that the March for Science movement has been criticized for is the idea that it's politicizing science. It's embroiling science, which should be pure and empirical and impartial, in a culture war, in a tribal conflict. What do either of you make of that criticism?
So March for Science is a nonpartisan movement. Our tagline is all related to science avoiding politics, but politics can't avoid science. And what that means is science itself should be nonpartisan, and the government should not use political beliefs to dictate funding for science. Research should be for the public good and not for a public agenda. And effective policy must rely on sound scientific research and data. We don't have a left agenda. We do not have a right-leaning agenda. We have an agenda for accuracy in the use of science, the responsible use of science and data and policy.
Right. And basically, we don't trust our leaders to lead us when they've got blinders on. We don't think they can make the best decisions when they don't have all the facts.
We're talking about the upcoming Rally for Science in Atlanta, part of the March for Science movement. It's going to be on Saturday. What's your end goal? Is there an end game here? What would you consider victory for this movement?
So we've got a handful of goals. We're trying to advance the use of evidence in policymaking, empower meaningful engagement between science and society. We're trying to foster diversity, inclusivity in all areas of science and science policy. And we're trying to build a global community of science advocates. So if we can achieve those, then we'd be really great.
Indeed. Let's talk to one of the folks who is going to be speaking at your rally, just to get a taste of the substance of what will be discussed. Let's bring in Linda DeGutis. She's an adjunct professor at Emory University School of Public Health. She's going to give the keynote speech at Saturday's Rally for Science in Atlanta. Linda, what's the short version of your talk?
I'm going to talk a little bit about the data and about the history of research in gun violence, and actually the lack of research that we've been able to do because there's been really minimal funding and limits on federal funding for gun violence research. And we really need the research, we need the science in order to find out what can work to help keep people safe, given that we do have guns in our environment. What are the kinds of things we can do so that people who should not have guns don't have them, so that children are not unintentionally killed with guns, that a child doesn't pick up a loaded gun that's sitting on a table or next to a bedside, so that women who are involved in relationships where there is abuse and there's violence in the relationship are not at high risk of being killed with a gun when they end the relationship or during some argument or fight in the relationship itself. So there are a number of things that we could actually be looking at and doing if we had the funding to support the science.
There has been some political debate about whether the federal government can or should be funding gun violence research at all at an institution like the CDC in Atlanta. What's the status of that?
While there is now in the new appropriations bill, a statement, not so much in the bill, but in the conference report that says that CDC should resume its work in gun violence, there was no additional funding in order to do that. And when we think about this as a public health issue, because of the number of deaths that occur every year, and by the way, 62% or so of the deaths are suicide, not homicide, which is not commonly recognized, I think, by a lot of people, there is no money really directed towards doing this research. So there's not money that goes to the CDC. There's not money that goes to the NIH to fund research. And it's really looking at, is there any money to fund people who are capable of doing the research? And this is not just at CDC and NIH, but really people in academic settings and in other places where they have the expertise and understand some of the issues related to gun violence and have already done some research, but could really do a lot more and help us learn what could be effective in decreasing the gun violence.
Getting back to what we were just talking about with Lewis and Allison, who are organizing the Rally for Science in Atlanta on Saturday, where you're going to be giving the keynote, the question of politicization. I can imagine that there would be people out there who would hear about the research that you're advocating for, Linda, and say, this is research that is inherently problematizing or pathologizing a tool, which is a firearm, right? Mm-hmm. And that the bigger problem is just violence, regardless of the weapon. What's the argument for studying gun violence in particular?
Well, I think if we think about this, it's that number one, when being injured or shot, you know, with a gun, has a much higher risk of lethality, for example, than maybe being stabbed with a knife, and it's not as easy to take a knife and stab 10 or 15 or 20 people in a single event and to create the same kind of damage that you would create with a gun. You don't have to necessarily be right next to somebody in order to injure them or kill them with a gun. You can be at a distance from them. It is not so much to say get rid of the guns. It's really more about how do we make people safe? How do we prevent some of the people who are at high risk of causing injuries and deaths using a gun from having access to them. You know, so how do we keep the perpetrator in a domestic violence situation from having a gun that he or she might use on a partner or ex-partner and perhaps other people who are in the the area that that partner is in? So it's really focusing a lot of ways in the way we did with motor vehicles and the way we continue to do it. We have cars. We know that people get killed in car crashes. We know that people are injured as they cross the street. They might be killed. But we've done a lot with both the environment and with vehicles to make them safer, to make people safer, so that they have a lower risk of being killed or injured by a car. We didn't take cars away. We just sort of changed some of the nature of the vehicles, the interior of the vehicle, the exterior of the vehicle, occupant protection. So there's many ways that we could be looking in a similar fashion at guns and gun violence.
We go back to Lewis and Allison, organizers of this Rally for Science happening in Atlanta on Saturday. You described the March for Science, the broader March for Science organization, as a nonpartisan organization. Can an organization be truly nonpartisan if there are obvious partisan implications, if you have one party that is rejecting science, another party embracing science?
So I think we need to recognize that science itself is just a process for gaining knowledge, no more, no less. It may tell us that guns are less safe or that humans are changing the environment, but doesn't address the moral issues. It doesn't weigh our constitutional rights versus safety. It doesn't tell us what the value of a human life is. But if we have people in Congress that are saying that they're trying to address an issue and they're ignoring the science, then they're just being disingenuous. And I think that's incredibly unfair to the people that they represent.
That's Lewis Kaifen. He's executive director of March for Science Atlanta. We also heard from Allison Halterman, the Atlanta March's executive vice president, and also from Linda DeGutis, who's going to give the keynote speech at this Saturday's March for Science rally in Atlanta. She's an adjunct professor at Emory University's School of Public Health. Thank you all very much.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. This past weekend, a group of college students gathered at Emory University for RespectCon. This conference addresses sexual violence on college campuses. In a moment, we'll hear about lessons learned from that event. But first, let's talk about a form of psychological abuse that is not well understood. It's called gaslighting. Nia Simone Ray worked as a teen reporter for Vox Teen Communications, an online magazine in Atlanta. And in 2016, she looked at how gaslighting can delay a victim's decision to come forward. Here's Nia Simone.
18-year-old Tylenza Hall is only weeks away from giving birth. The Atlanta Technical College student says she's excited about being a mother. It's her first child, a boy, who she has already named Tristan. But she's raising him without the baby's father.
He love me, but he don't. Because the way he treat me, he say mean things to me that hurt my feelings. And it's like when I bring it back up to him, he get amnesia.
What seemed to be a loving relationship at first gradually worsened as her boyfriend became verbally abusive. She recalls confronting him, but those conversations led to a dead end.
You said it and you hurt me, and now that I'm bringing it back up to you, you don't know what I'm talking about.
Unable to get through to her partner, she was left questioning whether she was the problem of the relationship rather than her boyfriend. What Tylenza Hall went through is called gaslighting. Because the phrases most associated with gaslighting are so commonly used in everyday conversation, friends and family can sometimes unknowingly perpetuate abuse outside of the dating relationship.
You're too sensitive.
You know you have trouble remembering things correctly.
You're always making something out of nothing.
You can't even remember what you had for breakfast this morning. How can you even trust your own memory?
According to the National Domestic Violence Hotline, gaslighting is a seemingly harmless yet rather common emotional abuse tactic. The term comes from the 1944 film Gaslight. The film features an emotionally abusive husband who manipulates his wife into questioning her own sanity for his personal gain. This dangerous tactic is primarily used by abusers in relationships.
And you thought I was being cruel to you. Keeping
no,
people away
not
from
cruel.
Making you a prisoner.
Oh, you're the kindest man in the world.
Whatever form gaslighting takes, its outcome is often the same. Isolate the victim and prolong the abuse. Margaret Lisi serves on the board for the Atlanta-based Partnership Against Domestic Violence. I caught up with her at this year's PADV Teen Summit, where teens from all over the metro Atlanta area gathered to learn about teen dating violence.
When I started dating, I dated guys who were abusive. And I just was, first of all, I was grateful for the attention. I was grateful to be validated, to be attracted enough to be dated by good-looking guys who are popular. And that they treated me badly was not unusual because that's the way my family treated me.
This is the type of story Macon-based attorney Tomika Daniel hears about on a regular basis. Danielle says that she handles domestic violence cases and that she often hears how complaints of abuse fall on deaf ears.
I just shared one of those stories where the mother was finally approached about the abuse that was going on with her daughter, and she says, oh, well, it's not that bad. It wasn't that bad. You know, again, it's kind of minimizing what the abused person feels and what they're going through, and once that abused person gets enough of that, they're going to start to believe it and say, well, gosh, maybe it really didn't happen. Maybe it wasn't as bad as I thought it was.
Daniel says even if they're not sure about abuse claims, adults can play a critical role in breaking the cycle of violence among teens.
One of the things that I try to tell the advocates is don't allow your own judgments to determine that there's no violence there, that there's no domestic violence. I always say let's take it to the judge and allow the judge to make the determination. That way, if we go before a judge and a judge says, well, there's no violence here, and then he kills her, they're going to look back at the judge's decision to find out how he made his decision. They're not going to look back at me and say, well, you didn't believe her enough to even take the case to court.
She says that speaking up about abuse is a matter of what's right and wrong.
They won't be legally responsible in that sense. Morally, they're going to feel really bad, but there is no legal responsibility against them, no.
But advocates say we should not wait until court to show support for victims of abuse. When I spoke earlier with Tylinza Hall, the pregnant 18-year-old from Atlanta, she told us about how her boyfriend abused her and then completely denied it. If it had not been for the support from her family and friends, she says that she might have never opened her eyes.
I used to think everything was my fault because of the things that he was doing, until I actually just was like, now I know it's not me, it's you. My friends don't like him, my family don't like him, and it's like I'm beginning to not like him as well.
As she reflects on the abusive relationship, Hall is focused on the future. As her journey begins, Hall has this advice to those on a similar path.
If you feel like you need to talk to yourself, talk to yourself. If you feel like you want to talk to somebody else, talk to somebody else. Like, if you want to talk to your cat, talk to your cat. I mean, people or something is always there to actually listen.
For Vox Teen Investigates, I'm Nia Simone Ray in Atlanta.
A story was produced in 2016 for Vox Teen Communications, an online magazine in Atlanta. Nia Simone Ray worked on it under the mentorship of On Second Thought producer Sean Powers. As I mentioned a moment ago, a group of college students gathered at Emory University last weekend for RespectCon. The annual event addresses social justice issues that involve sexual violence on college campuses. The conference centers on student conversations and the ways that they help sexual assault victims find justice. Wanda Swan is the director of the Respect Program at Emory. She talked about the rationale behind the conference.
It is really like a check-in, like how has the year treated you? How are you doing? Let's talk through some major trends that happened this past year. What are your campuses doing? What can we learn from what your campuses are doing?
Now, with movements like hashtag MeToo and Time's Up, sexual violence is, again, at the forefront of national attention. Venkayla Haynes is a regional advisor for It's On Us. This is a campaign that was started by the Obama administration, and it focuses on preventing sexual violence on college campuses. Now the campaign is part of the Biden Foundation. Venkayla, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You're a student at Spelman College, yes?
Yes.
How did you get involved in this issue?
I got involved with this issue from personal experience, experiencing child abuse, rape in college, and also a domestic violence relationship. So my experience with experiencing three different forms of violence kind of motivated me into getting into this work, helping other survivors, and also educating myself on the issue of gender-based violence.
What are your goals?
My goals right now is to continue to hold my institution accountable for what they are and are not doing around Title IX. Helping survivors, continuing this work on a national level, so that's college campuses, K-12, eventually out of the country, and also running for public office in the future.
It's amazing how far I think the broader culture has come on recognizing the significance of sexual violence. It's the scope of the problem on college campuses in particular, how mm-hmm. serious it is and things that must be done to prevent it. What do you think about where our culture is right now in the quote-unquote Me Too moment? Is that really advancing your cause?
I think the Me Too movement is a great cause that was started by a Black woman. It's a great way for survivors to come up and to come forward and to talk about their similar experiences. With Time's Up, I also think it's a great initiative to help workers who have been affected by sexual violence in the workplace. But I think where we're missing the mark is that when we're talking about Me Too and Time's Up, we're not centering marginalized survivors. So that's Black women, trans women, queer folks, disabled folks, undocumented immigrants. So until we explore sexual violence on those intersections and talk about the homophobia, the transphobia, the racism, the sexism, the misogyny, the patriarchy, and how that leads to sexual violence, we're not truly dedicated to eradicating rape culture.
Yeah, you talk about marginalized survivors. Certainly sexual assault is pervasive on college campuses. It's a problem particular to college and university campuses. But I have wondered sometimes if the emphasis that is placed on sexual assault at college in particular, that might at least in part be a result of the social privilege enjoyed by college students relative to the general population, that these are people who have the ability, the platform, the voice to make their concerns known, and that focusing on sexual assault on college campuses might obscure the conversation about sexual assault everywhere else in society. What do you make of that?
I think that's correct. A lot of times on college campuses, when survivors come forward, when survivors decide to speak out, they're often faced with retaliation. From my personal experience speaking out about sexual violence that I experienced my freshman year of college, it was very hard for me to come forward. It was very hard for me to talk about it. And when I first kind of got the strength to talk about it, I was victim blamed by certain administrators, certain students, and it kind of just added to my trauma in a very negative way. I wish that with college campuses, we found a way to actually protect survivors and give them the right resources, especially at HBCUs, because we know that they're greatly underfunded. They don't have the resources to deal with sexual violence. They're very understaffed. So I think it's about more of having this education and also protecting survivors when they come forward about their stories.
I think a lot of people would be surprised, Venkayla, to hear about the your experience of what happened to you at your school with regard to what administrators said or did to you, considering that you go to Spelman. Spelman's a women's college. I think one would naturally expect them to be better at handling this kind of thing. Is that not true?
That is true. You would expect them to be handle this type of thing correctly, but we all know that HBCUs and any college institution has a really huge problem with dealing with sexual violence. There's always this thing, especially in the Black community, seeing that HBCUs are historically Black colleges and universities, where we have to keep it in the house and not really talk about it and not put a negative image on our institution or protect Black men and not let them be a part of the system that was only here to, like, fail us and not protect us. So it's kind of like protecting our own, not talking about it, and not putting that negative image on the institution.
So what do you say to combat that attitude?
I feel like there's accountability has to take place. Especially within the AUC, which is Morehouse, Spelman, and Clark, we had protests such as Raped at Spelman, and We Know What You Did, which sparked a lot of national conversation and local conversation around sexual violence. In order for us to move forward, in order for survivors to continue to report, we have to make the campus environment safe, because it's not safe right now. For my personal experience, coming into Spelman in 2013, my freshman year, I was sexually assaulted in one of the student apartments that's like 10 minutes away from campus. During NSO, which is new student orientation, we didn't have adequate conversations around sexual assault. They gave us a rape whistle and told us to basically blow this whistle if you're experiencing sexual assault. And for my situation, I don't know how that could be a great solution if I'm off campus and public safety is on campus.
So what are some substantive steps that you're looking for college administrators to take to prevent sexual assault?
I would start by having these conversations during NSO and throughout the school year. As I mentioned earlier, during NSO, they gave us a rape whistle, told us that the surrounding area of the Atlanta University Center was dangerous, and they never talked to us about the type of violence that can happen within our own campuses. We also have this thing in the AUC called EverFi, which is like this online module around alcohol awareness and sexual violence, but a lot of students really don't complete those modules, or they just don't pay attention when they're doing it. It's kind of like just, oh, I'm just going to answer these questions and that's going to be it. We have to actually be invested in sitting down and having these hard conversations with college students, because that's the only way to get better solutions. And I would definitely also say, in regards to Title IX, a lot of students, I would honestly say over 80% of the campus, they don't know what Title IX is. They don't know what resources they can get. They don't know what accommodations they can get under Title IX. So we also have to do better at educating students on their Title IX rights instead of violating them, and make sure that when we have our counseling services, our mental health services, and our therapists, that we're not understaffed, and those people in these powerful positions are not victim blaming as well.
As we mentioned, you're the regional advisor for It's On Us. That's mm-hmm. a campaign that started under the Obama administration. It's now under the Biden Foundation. The Obama administration was very aggressive on this issue of sexual assault on college campuses. One of the things that they did was to really push colleges to be more aggressive in how they handle accusations of sexual assault within their own on-campus judicial processes. And there was a bit of a backlash to that. A lot of people saying that on-campus judicial processes tended to deny the accused basic due process rights to defend themselves. And I think there's been a bit of a move to try to push this back into the criminal justice system for that very reason. What do you make of those developments?
My thing about due process is no one was ever against due process. That was basically a narrative that was created by mostly men's rights activists. So there was no issue with due process on the Obama administration. The issue was that when survivors reported, they were not believed, they were victim blamed, and nothing was just being taken seriously. So we have issues with, like, Betsy DeVos, who rescinded the Dear Colleague letter because she thought that the rights were being violated for the quote-unquote falsely accused. So I don't think that due process was an issue. In regards to the criminal justice system, I don't think that college campuses should have any faith in the criminal justice system, or even survivors having faith in the criminal justice system, especially survivors who look like me, survivors who are Black, and survivors who are women, or survivors who are a part of any marginalized community, because with the criminal justice system, they don't protect us. For me and my personal beliefs, this system was not made for me. This system was not made to protect me. And police officers and law enforcement don't go through any type of sensitivity training to adequately deal with sexual violence. And police misconduct and sexual assault is the second highest form of police brutality. So it's kind of those type of conversations and that type of information that's not going to make me feel comfortable with reporting to law enforcement, because they're not— that's not a system that's going to protect me at all. That's a system that's only going to harm me. We have issues with Black men being killed, Black women being sexually assaulted by law enforcement. So we can't expect HBCU students to report to law enforcement.
That's Venkayla Haynes. She is a student at Spelman College and an activist working on the problem of campus sexual assault. Thank you so much for the talk.
Thank you for having me.
The Atlanta-based hospital chain Piedmont Healthcare and health insurance company Blue Cross Blue Shield of Georgia are at loggerheads. The two failed to reach a contract agreement by their April 1st deadline that has left tens of thousands of Georgia patients caught in the middle. Georgia Governor Nathan Deal has called both sides back to the negotiating table now to discuss what these bones of contention are and the chances of there being any kind of resolution to the patient's advantage. We've got Andy Miller. He's the editor of Georgia Health News. Welcome back, Andy. What's the deal with Piedmont Healthcare? This has got to be one of the biggest healthcare providers in the state, right?
They have 11 hospitals now, and they are clearly on an expansion mode.
Based in Atlanta and covering North Georgia mostly?
Well, they just picked up a hospital in Columbus. They just added another hospital in Monroe. They clearly dominate the southern suburbs of Atlanta, and then they have the kind of the flagship hospital in Buckhead.
So what does it mean for Blue Cross Blue Shield to not have a contract with Piedmont right now? Does that mean if my insurance is Blue Cross Blue Shield of Georgia, like I can't, and I go to a Piedmont hospital or a doctor's office, like I'm not going to get reimbursed for the charges that I incur?
You're going to face higher out-of-pocket costs for going out of network. Now, Governor Deal has protected state employees and university system employees for up to 30 days by saying that the state and the university system will pay their out-of-network costs if they go to a Piedmont doctor or a Piedmont hospital.
All right. So what are they fighting about?
It's all about money. I mean, the reimbursement that they're negotiating, what Blue Cross will pay Piedmont anywhere from a doctor visit all the way through heart bypass surgery and everything in between. And Blue Cross has said that they have made an offer that's three times the general inflation rate, and they say that Piedmont is asking for more than that.
Who holds more cards in this situation, the hospital chain that actually delivers the care or the insurance company that has the money?
Well, I think it depends on what the situation is. I think both of these are heavyweights, okay? You've got Blue Cross, which is clearly the biggest health insurer in the state, and you've got Piedmont, which is one of the leading, if not the leading, hospital system in the state. And so each side kind of needs each other, particularly if you're Blue Cross, you're going to need coverage in those southern Atlanta suburbs and where there's no alternative but going to a Piedmont hospital.
What does the dispute between Piedmont and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Georgia say about the broader healthcare industry? Is this a problem that is particular to them, or is this an impasse that is endemic?
Well, we're seeing more of these contracts between insurers and big hospital systems lapse without an agreement. It used to be that just about every one of them would be settled right before the deadline and no one would have to worry about going out of network. Now, nationally, we're seeing more of these kind of lapse and patients kind of thrown out of network. And I think it comes down to the battle and the tension between an insurance company and a big hospital system and who's going to control the patient and who's going to control the doctors.
Is it about control or is it about money? Is there just not enough money to go around anymore?
Well, what happens is basically this is one of the reasons why healthcare costs go up higher than the general inflation rate is because hospital systems are, ask for more money and insurance companies typically wind up paying. I think that this dispute will get resolved because both sides need each other.
Andy Miller, editor of Georgia Health News, talking about a contract dispute between Piedmont Healthcare and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Georgia. Their contract lapsed April 1st. We'll see what happens. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks for having me.
A striking new memorial details a painful legacy in American history. The National Memorial for Peace and Justice opens its doors April 26th in Montgomery, Alabama. It documents lynchings of thousands of African-American men, women, and children in the years after the Civil War and well into the 20th century. The museum's stories are based on findings from the Alabama-based Equal Justice Initiative, which says nearly 4,000 African-Americans were lynched in the American South between the end of the Civil War and World War II. Catherine Fletcher remembers seeing a classmate being lynched about 80 years ago in Missouri. Fletcher, who died a few years ago, talked about it on PBS.
They chained him to the back of a car and dragged him up and down the main street in the black neighborhood, screaming, this will happen to. Then they hanged him to a tree and set a fire under him and burned his body.
And to learn more about this troubling part of American history, we spoke with now retired University of Georgia professor E.M. Beck, who studies lynchings in the South. We also talked about it with Doria Johnson, whose great-great-grandfather was lynched in South Carolina nearly a century ago, and she researched that part of her family history. My colleague Celeste Headley spoke with them.
There's been a lot of debate recently about the definition of terrorism, and we're hearing a lot of, some of these researchers like from the Equal Justice Initiative talk about lynchings as a form of terrorism. I wonder what you think of that characterization.
The effect of lynchings on a community certainly would have be terrorism. If you can imagine a situation of where a group of people come in, take a loved one, kill them, and there is no reaction to law, and there's no particular reaction from the newspapers. And in fact, there may be a great deal of sentiment that the mob did a very good thing. Now, what message does that send to a community? And it's one that you're vulnerable and that we can do to you whatever basically we want to do. And that is essentially a terrorist message.
And I wonder, Doria, your great-grandfather was killed this way. I wonder what kind of effect it had on your family.
It had a devastating effect on my family and community, so that most people wanted to leave. I was told those who had the means to do so did leave, and our family was actually ordered out of town.
And your family did move?
Yeah, most of us did move. Half moved to Philadelphia, the other half of the kids moved to D.C., and my family moved specifically to Evanston, Illinois, where we already have relatives.
Were you aware of the nature of your great-grandfather's death your whole life, or was it something you discovered later?
Very early I was told the story about his lynching, probably in kindergarten, first grade, when my school was integrated. And my grandfather was concerned that I was befriending white, and he told me the story of Grandpa Crawford and suggested that I not trust white people because, you know, they'll kill us, and you know, it just was not a good thing to do.
And did that make you afraid to befriend white kids?
No, I mean, you know, as a first grader, you can't really grasp the meaning of lynching, but I grew into the history and the terror that it left on my family.
Well, I don't want to bring up some painful past history, but what led to your great-grandfather's death? Was he accused of committing a crime?
He was accused of committing a social infraction, which was cursing a white man over the price of some cottonseed.
Let me go back to you then, Professor. It seems to me like in many cases it would be impossible to know how many lynchings occurred. I mean, in some cases... we know that in some cases people took photos and they took souvenirs, but I imagine in many cases they also didn't talk about it.
Let me make two comments. First, back to Anthony Crawford. He was accused of cursing a white man, but perhaps a bigger infraction is that he was very successful. Mm. He was a very successful farmer in Abbeville in South Carolina, and to the degree which there may have been sort of jealousy and sort of motivated some of the hostile reaction to him is probably a reasonable guess. Now, in terms of your other question, is that there were lynchings in every part of the United States. The exact number will be very difficult to ever determine. Certainly, if we look at the American South, and excluding Texas in this case, we're looking at over 3,000 instances between 1877 and 1950, with almost 3,900 people being lynched. And of those two, about 84% were African Americans. Research continues. The typical lynching incident occurred at night, not by a huge mob, but a fairly dedicated group of men that would say be 15 to 20, where a person was taken from custody and then hauled up a tree and left to strangle or shot. At that point,
as I understand, more lynchings occurred in Georgia between the late 1800s and 1950 than any other state. Why here?
Well, actually, it's not clear to me that Georgia, it's a race, if in some sense, between Mississippi and Georgia, who had the most victims. So it's one of those things that, you know, the difference between Mississippi and Georgia is very small in the number of people killed. So, you know, now why specifically Mississippi and why specifically Georgia? Well, I think it's a fairly complex issue. There are questions about the relationships between blacks and whites, and lynching is a form of social control. And there's a question about how in the American South with after Reconstruction, how were African-American laborers to be controlled? And so there was a variety of techniques, and sort of lynch mob violence was one that can be very intimidating. And of course, the negative aspect of that, besides the personal loss, is the thing that Ms. Johnson mentioned, is that it was also an incentive for many African-Americans to leave the American South and to go to places like Chicago or Pittsburgh or Toledo.
I'm going to play you this comment from Brian Stevenson with the Equal Gesture Initiative, and he's talking about certain requirements that he used when deciding what's a lynching and what isn't.
It's got to be something that involved three or more people involved in the act of murder. It had to be something done by people who had no or very little fear of reprisal or being held accountable. It had to be in response to some perceived misconduct, not always a crime. And then we had to confirm that the victims were in fact killed.
And he could be describing exactly your great-grandfather's death. What steps were taken, if any, to bring justice to your family for your great-grandfather's murder?
Well, Governor Manning considered himself a progressive and, certainly sent resources down to Abbeville to investigate the lynching. However, you know, I've got the report. It, you know, it looks like a ream of paper. It names names. It talks about who was in the crowd and why. Some were government officials, and certain people were brought to an inquest, and the coroner, who was also in the mob, suggested that Grandpa Crawford came to his death at the hands of persons unknown.
It's been a very, very long time. Is there still a sense with you and your family that you need closure?
Yeah, absolutely. We have never forgotten. It's a part of our family history that's passed down, but so is the pain. You know, you look at the Great Migration and you wonder, how did you end up away from family? And, you know, these stories are often central to why people left the South. They were forced out.
So let me go back to you, E.M. Beck. There has been some efforts recently to try and discover the perpetrators of some of these lynchings, especially some of the more extreme ones, such as the one at Moore's Ford Bridge in 1946 in Georgia. What are the chances there can actually be charges brought in these cases?
Pretty slim. I've been involved with Moore's Ford for over a decade. And there's been ongoing investigation by the GBI and by the FBI.
That's a Georgia Bureau of Investigation.
Yes,
yeah.
Correct. One of the GBI agents told me, he said that when they went to the archive to pull out the materials from the original 1946 investigation, it was one small box. And he said there's very little to go on. There's very little forensics. People know who was involved, but the whole community basically got silenced. And so the idea of getting a successful prosecution is probably extremely rare.
I wanted to read you a comment from a man who's connected to that investigation, Doria, to the investigation into Moore's Ford Bridge, in which four people were tied up and shot 60 times by a white mob. He said in that relation, why in the world are y'all bringing stuff up that happened 60 years ago? Why didn't y'all do something about it then? What would be your answer to that? Why worry about this decades later?
You know, those sorts of quotes are the reason I get up and go to the archives every morning. And it's because we can't forget. So there's a stain on American history. And in fact, it's just part of, you know, sort of our normal social structure to have attitudes like that. You know, where family members are taken and murdered. And so the history and trajectory of families are changed. And then to hear something like that is highly offensive, and it suggests that we need to come and to reconcile and make this part of sort of the normal narrative of America.
I wonder, Professor Beck, if you think that America has just not honestly dealt with that era in its history.
Well, the simple answer is yes, of course. The more complex answer is that as things go back within the African-American community, there is a long oral tradition, a memory, a collective memory of African-American experience in this country. I think amongst many in the white community, their sense of history ends, you know, one generation past. It's easy to walk away from. With the Moore's Ford case, the county in which that occurred has changed dramatically demographically since 1946. Most of the people that live there now moved into that area, many from the North and the Midwest, and so they have no connection to it. So it's a very different experience. I like to think of it in some ways is that it hacks on a greater, much greater reality in the African-American community than it does in the white community.
That's retired University of Georgia professor E.M. Beck. He studied lynchings in the South. We also heard from Doria Johnson, whose great-great-grandfather was lynched in South Carolina. They spoke with my colleague Celeste Headley. Later this month, the National Memorial for Peace and Justice opens its doors in Montgomery, Alabama. It documents the lynchings of thousands of African Americans in the years after the Civil War.